in a Midwest American town, and the sheriff was needing a new deputy, and they were interviewing a number of people. And this one man came in, and the sheriff knew that, well, this guy has a good heart, but he's maybe not the smartest of the interviewees. And so he said to him, so I'm just going to ask a few questions here. And so the first question he asked was, what's 1 and 1? And the guy answered, 11. And the sheriff thought, well, that wasn't the answer I was thinking of, but, you know, he's right. And then he asked the question, so which 2 days of the week start with the letter T? And the guy said, today and tomorrow. And the sheriff said, you know, he's right, although that's not the answer I had in mind. Then he thought, well, I'm going to give him one that might be a little bit tougher. And he said, who killed Abraham Lincoln? And the guy said, I don't know. And the sheriff said, well, okay, why don't you go and think about that for a while and you come back and see me tomorrow. So the guy left the interview and went and found his friends at the pub and he said, it's great, the job is mine. First day on the job and I've already got a murder case to solve. So I tell this story because it's kind of humorous and it's always good to begin a homily with a humorous story, but there's a much deeper point here. We need to know the larger narrative in which our lives are taking place. The killing, the murder, the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Oh, and by the way, it was John Wilkes Booth who killed him. This is central to the American narrative. And if you're an American and you don't know that, you kind of wonder, where have you been sleeping? But there's a much larger narrative that all of us are part of, and it's the narrative of God's story. But so many people today have no concept of this larger narrative arc in which we are to live our lives. And Lent is a time of the year where, again, we are invited to remember where we are and who we are. We are to remember where we are and who we are. You've perhaps heard of St. Ignatius of Loyola, the great 16th century Catholic who established the Jesuit order. And St. Ignatius of Loyola understood something that our catechism articulates this way. Reading now from the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Man is divided in himself. As a result, the whole life of people, both individual and social, shows itself to be a struggle and a dramatic struggle between good and evil, between light and darkness. The way St. Ignatius talked about this is he said, imagine two armies at war. And in the 16th century, your army would be marked by a flag called the standard. And what St. Ignatius of Loyola teaches is the following. On the field of life, we have to ask ourselves the question, under which standard are we going to stand? Under the flag of Jesus Christ, or over the flag, or under the flag of the enemy of our soul, the devil? Today's readings are very, very clear in articulating this fundamental theme of saying, where are we? We're on the battlefield of life. And each person is called to make a choice. In that reading that we had from St. Paul's letter to the Romans, Paul talks about the first Adam, who in the end chose to stand under the standard of the evil one. And then he talks about the second Adam, the one who establishes the army under his leadership, the Lord Jesus Christ. And the fundamental truth is this, Paul says, when we learn to stand under the flag of Jesus, then Paul says, we can have victory and dominion in life. So I want to unpack this for us now over these next couple of minutes by looking first at the reading from Genesis and then at our gospel. Because you see, in this reading from Genesis, we learn fundamental truths about how the enemy operates. And I am no general of an army of the sort that would fight in a battle, but one of the things I am sure that the commanders need to know is the strategy of the enemy. So what's the strategy of our enemy? Well, remember, first of all, that the garden is a good garden. The garden is a garden filled with copious trees, with abundant fruit. It is a garden of incredible generosity. And this is a representation of how we are to see life, that life is abundant, life is full. But the very first thing that the devil will try to do is to get us to doubt God's goodness. The devil will get us to doubt God's goodness. Remember what he says to Eve. Did God really say to you that you can't eat from any of these beautiful trees? You can't eat from those apple trees. Don't touch those pear trees. Oh, and those beautiful cherries, God doesn't want you to have them. No, because God's not good. Now, thankfully, Eve does not take that bait. She knows that that's not what God said at all. You're wrong, serpent. We can eat from any of these trees, except for the one, the knowledge of good and evil. We can't eat from that one, because if we eat from that one, God said we'll die. So see what the devil does? He could not get Eve to doubt God's goodness. So what he does next is he gets her to doubt God's truthfulness. You won't die. You don't have to believe that story. And then, that little bait, ooh, it's looking good. Oh, Eve, don't bite. Oh, no, she bit it. Because, wow, it tastes good. It looks good. And it will make me wise. Pause 1 second. Eve gets a bum rap in this story. Like, what about Adam? The guy's there the whole time. Okay, maybe it was Sunday afternoon and he was watching NFL football and he just couldn't care. Or maybe he was on his phone or on some sort of other device and he just kind of missed what was going on with Eve. But here's the point. One of the devil's strategies is in some ways he'll try to attack us through the feminine. Because women, by their very nature, are more prone to be spiritual. But the guy is there the whole time. And here's the thing, Adam was the one to whom God had spoken. Adam is the one to whom God had said, don't eat from the tree. And clearly he'd shared this news with Eve. Because when Adam is told those words in Genesis 2, Eve is not there. So the only way Eve knows is because Adam had told her. But now what does he do? Nothing, he's a wimp. He's like many modern men. He is. There are so many modern men who are abdicating any sense of responsibility in the family. So many modern men who are abdicating any sense of what it is to be a man. And the devil loves it. Because when that happens in societies, when everything falls to the women to have to try to make it work, which happens far too often, society begins to collapse. But this is not a 21st century phenomenon. It's right here in the book of Genesis. And now the devil's got them where he wants them. Because we're told they sew together fig leaves and they cover up from one another. And we don't read the next part of the story, but it now turns into a blame game. Where Adam says to God, well, God, if you hadn't made this particular gal, you know, God, so it's your fault. And then Eve says, well, if it wasn't for this darn snake, and by the way, who made this snake? God, it's your fault. And this is what happens. So what do we need in such a situation? We need a real man to show up. And thankfully he does. The man who is also fully God. But what you need to understand about the temptation story is this is a particular point where Jesus in his humanity is combating the strategy of the devil. And what is so interesting is in each case, the devil begins with, if you're the Son of God. Now, just before this had been the baptism, right? Where the voice of the Father had said, you're my Son, the Beloved, with you I'm well pleased. What does the devil try to do with Jesus? Well, he knows he won't be able to get Jesus on that, you know, God's not good line, because, like, I am God. But maybe he can get him on. Maybe you're not really the Messiah. You don't have to trust what God said. So he uses the same strategy with the Son of God as he uses with Adam and Eve. And yet this time it doesn't work. Why? See the move. You're hungry, aren't you, Jesus? Like, I'd be hungry too. I don't know what you're thinking going 40 days without food, but you have. But you know, because you're not only man, you're God. You see those rocks there? Wouldn't that make some beautiful sourdough bread? Can't you smell it? Oh, I've got the butter. I've got the toaster over here. Let's just toast some of this stuff up. And then we can spread that butter and some maybe nice honey on top of it, Jesus. Come on, let's just do it. And of course, Jesus says no. Now, what's this all about? What's another thing the devil will do to try to entice us? All you need is this material world. It will satisfy you every time. And when you get bored with one part of your material world, well, just buy something else. And that's going to satisfy your restless heart. Oh, I know, after a while you'll get bored with that, but just keep on spending. And here's the way we counter this during Lent. That this voice is a powerful voice. So Jesus said, learn to fast. One of the three disciplines of Lent is fasting. I was thinking about this the other day as I was fasting, and I was kind of grumpy. And I thought to myself, I'm never grumpy on a feast day. I'm never grumpy when it's like, oh, Father, would you like a second glass of wine? I don't go, no, I don't want a second glass. Of course I want a second glass of wine. But on a day when I can't eat something that I want, man, I can get grumpy. Fasting is hard. It does not come naturally to us. But I want to ask you, what are you fasting from this Lent? And maybe if you cannot fast because of a health condition, what good thing, something that you really like, are you willing to put down for the days of Lent because you want to become less attached to the world? That is one of the fundamental spiritual disciplines of the 2,000-year Catholic tradition, that something happens to us when we say, I know it's going to be hard and I might fail today, but then I'll start again tomorrow. Please use Lent as a time to prayerfully consider the purposeful decision to fast from something good. What does the devil do next? Go to the city of Jerusalem and to the pinnacle. Now, the Jerusalem Temple is one of the wonders of the ancient world. It was an amazing building. And so what the devil does is says, Jesus, go to the very top of that building and jump off of it. Test God about death. Will he catch you or will you be dead? And this is the second thing that the devil always does, is he wants to confuse us about the nature of our mortality and about the nature of death. And in some ways, what he would say is, take death into your own hands. And, you know, God, he'll be there. Jump, he'll catch you. This is a very modern temptation. For in our day, when you think of the horror of abortion, and now what's happening with medical assistance and dying, the devil's got Canadians right where he wants them. Play with death. You are the master of your life, you are the master of your death, and you can do what you want. So how do we counter this lie? Well, the other discipline Jesus calls us to, which is prayer. Because prayer is the way that helps us to become aware of our mortality. Now, if we find fasting hard, I think in our society, prayer is even more difficult. Because almost all of us are attached to our electronic devices. And our brains have been so wired to be stimulated that it's really hard for us to sit quietly. We are a very restless generation. And I speak about this myself included. I find it very difficult to come in here during Eucharistic adoration and even spend 20, 25 minutes just sitting still. But I know it's good for me, and I need to practice it. So may I invite you to consider one form of prayer during Lent. Join us on Friday evenings when we have soup at 6, stations at 7, adoration from 7:30 till 10 to 8, and benediction at 10 to 8 until 8. If you're going to come for soup, make sure you register online because we want to know how many people are going to come. And let me conclude by moving to the third temptation. Look at the world, Jesus. Not only the world, I am showing you the splendor. This is such a terrifying temptation, especially for religious people. How shocked we all were to hear about Jean Vanier and a man who had done such good with the establishing of L'Arche could have done such evil in manipulating and controlling women with this sort of twisted theology. That's this third temptation. It's using other people for our own manipulative ends. And it's rife in our society, and tragically, it's far too present in the church as well. So how do we counter that? The third discipline of Lent, almsgiving. And of course, almsgiving is specifically giving of money to the poor, but the deeper thing around almsgiving is practicing the spiritual and corporal acts of mercy, living a life of true generosity in relation to the other, willing what is good for the other. Well, I've gone on this morning, but I felt it so important to share this homily with you and to conclude with these words from Pope Benedict, who said, "At the heart of all temptations is the act of pushing God aside because we perceive him as secondary, if not actually superfluous and annoying, in comparison with all the apparently more urgent matters that fill our lives." May you and I say, Jesus Christ is not superfluous. I choose to stand under his standard because Jesus has given me a job assignment to battle with him and for him through the course of our earthly life.